What's interesting is when you think about the retirement crisis, right? So for all Americans, and more specifically why it's a crisis, it's because most Americans expect to maintain the same standard of living while they're not working.
Right.
Right. And it goes back to what we were saying before around the idea of detoxing from a leveraged or subsidized life. Like retirement isn't like other milestones. Like there's no loan that you can take out for 30 years
right.
and like pay mortgage, it back yeah. like a mortgage just so you can have it. Like you have to save for it or do what a lot of people do, which is to find a new source of subsidization. Mm-hmm. And what is also normal is like, well, you know, your children step in to help. And that's where when
right.
you talk
that's
about that
$10,000
to $20,000 gap, that's typically where the children come into play or where the combination of children and or retirees living lives on credit come into play, right? Where it's like, right. this is only how much money I have. This is only so much that Junior or my daughter can offer me. And then the rest, I sort of just make a payment on a credit card. And that's normal. Like what we see are people that are living retired lives, trying to make what they have last as long as possible, living their lives essentially subsidized on credit. And what I think is, I won't say ironic, but interesting is that like it all leads to the same goal. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten. And today we're talking about retirement, more specifically, what people get wrong about it.
Yes, we alluded to this actually in our last episode. It was one of the conversations people should be having.
Right.
I saw a couple of tweets about that. So shout out to all the people who were...
Said we read them.
Yeah. No, I feel like they were actually having some uncomfortable conversations. So I'm right there with you. I know those can be tough, but we applaud you for actually taking the step. This conversation or this podcast is a bit of an extension of that. And it's top of mind because we literally, as of yesterday, finished recording the audiobook version of our book, Cashing Out. And it was such an experience because obviously we've read the book, we wrote the book, but reading it out loud and thinking about and trying to envision the people who would actually be listening to it was a really interesting experience. And I'll be honest, as I was reading, there were certain parts of the book or certain stories that were like really transporting me back to the moment that we were having these conversations, good or bad. And it was just a really, really interesting thing. So I just think it's helpful because when we think about things like retirement and trying to demystify that idea, there's a lot to be said about trying to ensure that people aren't trapping themselves into certain beliefs, because that's like what a big part of the book is about. It's like trying to break these old beliefs and just like confronting people with evidence and saying, hey, like you do not have to work your entire life. Like I know you've heard that. And I know that you've taken pride in that idea, but you don't have to do that.
Right. Yeah. I think it's the perfect swan song to the end of Financial Literacy Month, because this is really the point of the whole thing.
Yeah.
The point of being financially literate, the point of working hard and, you know, getting those good jobs and the income is so that you can retire.
Yeah.
And we just lose so much sight of that because we're so busy focused on optimizing and hacking our way through, you know, learning, you know, becoming rich.
Yes.
But the point is to actually, you know, be in control of your days.
And I'm just going to say, I think one of the things I've realized is just how much we, and by we, I mean Americans, are visual learners. And I think a big part of that is that when we talk about retirement, like it conjures up very specific images.
Yes.
That is why people feel so disconnected from it. It was like, well, I don't have to worry about that. Like, and it was like, no, you do. Like, you literally do. We all do. That's part of our existence. And I think that's part of the reason why so many people are just kind of kicking the can down the turn. Kicking the can
down the road.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned it earlier, as in like 2 minutes ago, but you mentioned that one of the techniques that we used to prepare for recording the audiobook was actually to think about a person who needed to hear each chapter or section and then to read it as if we're talking to them.
Yeah.
Like literally imagining somebody, some of it is some of y'all, to be honest, listeners, we would be imagining y'all and saying what we would say to you if we were in person.
Yeah.
And one day on the way in, we were just kind of talking and we brought up our parents and how in some ways, they're still struggling with what they thought retirement is supposed to look like. I'm using air quotes.
Yep.
And what it actually is, right? It's almost like the realization of the choices you've made in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something brilliant. You said like some of the sadness, and sadness is probably a heavy word, but the malaise or whatever that some retirees experience.
Melancholy, maybe.
Yeah. Okay, Love Jones. Some of the melancholy that people experience is really just a credit detox.
Yes.
It's almost like withdrawals.
Yeah.
From being propped up by credit their whole lives.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it was like people don't realize just how much of their lives are subsidized or essentially living off of credit, right? You're so accustomed to that. And I'm going to be honest, like we were talking about one of our parents, right? Like it was like you're struggling in retirement right now because you never really had a clear understanding of how much it actually cost to live because you lived your entire life partially subsidized by an employer, and the rest of it, you filled in the blanks on credit.
Yes, right? Which required a pay stub from
your
employer.
So you never really had an idea of how much it costs. And so now that you're living this life, you're trying to commit to being debt-free, you're really frustrated by how expensive things are. And it's like, well, yeah, like that's not a fault of the world. It's the fact that you didn't really properly prepare for what you're experiencing or living through right now. And so if you think about that, or even if you're listening to that and you're thinking about your own parents or yourselves, I want you to really think about the number of things that employers subsidize in your life. And so healthcare, for example, one of the biggest things or the biggest critiques that people offer when it comes to retirement or the FIRE movement is that, oh, well, what do you do for healthcare? And I was like, yeah, because most people have no idea how much it actually costs to pay for healthcare out of pocket. And when they see that, it's like sticker shock. And all of a sudden, I was like, well, I'm going to keep this job then.
Right.
And then they end up just constantly working their entire lives, right? 401k contributions, for example. People are so accustomed to the notion that getting a match is a part of investing. Mm-hmm. And it's only because they only invest through employer-sponsored plans. Mm-hmm. So if you mention an option where there's not, let's say, a double or triple tax benefit, they're like, well, why would I do that? I was like, because you actually have full control. There's benefit to having control as opposed to putting your funds in something that is actually controlled by an institution that your employer has offered you, even down to things like meals. Like there are so many people who don't factor in the fact that, yeah, well, about two or three times out of the week, you can rely on your manager or your customer.
Yeah, yeah. Right. This bagel coffee in the break room.
When you're not doing that, you have to add that to your budget because you drink coffee. You want to go to lunch. You want to do all of those things. And so, yeah, it's just a really interesting thing that I think a lot of people don't factor in. And as a result, it makes dealing with retirement and the actual costs of living in retirement really complicated.
Yeah. And Black Freelance brought this up on Twitter the other week. Shout out to Black Freelance. But they were just talking about the other part of that equation is that people think that employers or corporations have this magical sense to be able to do this for you.
Right.
But what it really boils down to is planning. They every year they look at their P&L statements, they look at their financial balances, they look at their salaries, and they say, we could pay you 80% more, but instead we're gonna shave that off and we're gonna reallocate it and just pay for these things that you don't think somebody is paying for.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like we're gonna use some of the salary we could have given you and just offset your healthcare because that's how you like for things to happen. Yeah. So anyway, I don't want to go on a rant about that. That's almost like a totally different podcast about how to plan like your employer does. But I do want to start with the first myth about retirement, which is that you need to plan assuming that you're going to fund all of your expenses for eternity with no additional income.
Right.
Right. And in some cases, have money left over to give to your children or other relatives.
Mm-hmm.
That's false.
Yep.
The goal of retirement is not to stop income. Right. The goal of retirement is really just to put you back in charge of how you spend your days and replace your income. Right. So a common guideline is that you should aim to replace about 70% of your annual pre-retirement income.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had an income of if you had a salary of $100,000 and after employee taxes, Social Security, retirement, healthcare deductions, you bring home about $70,000. You should aim to replace anywhere from $50,000 a year to $70,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
I've left it as a range because depending on how you construct your income sources, your tax rates may change. But you can plan to replace that pre-retirement income a number of ways. You can use passive income through a combination of savings, investments, Social Security. You might have a pension or a rental property. Mm-hmm. Or you can add other active income sources. You can take on some part-time work, or you can, like your dad does, do taxes 3 months a year.
Yeah, he's been doing taxes. I'm glad you mentioned it. I was going to mention it. But yeah, I mean, my father's been retired for probably 20 years at this point. Mm-hmm. But he has not let his tax business go.
Yeah.
He actually looks forward to it. We know we can't go see him during tax season because he's busy. He's still doing the taxes of his friends, you know, that he's known for and been doing their taxes for 30, 40 years. And he brings some supplemental income. That's in addition to, you know, what he does. He enjoys it. It keeps him sharp. It keeps, you know, helps to maintain a social calendar. And, you know, he's living his life down in Florida.
Yeah. It's quite common to still earn income in retirement. It's actually more than normal. I think it's 80% of people still earn income in retirement.
Yep.
But this is where people get tripped up. So I want to throw out a few stats, and I hope I'm going to try to read them slowly because they're so important. The first one is that the average retirement age in the United States among living retirees is just under 60 years old. It's 59.88 years, right? So it's that 59 and a half range. People tend to quit right after that. The median living retiree left work at 62 years old. And the most common age to retire is 62, which is technically early, right? Social Security is considered the primary source of guaranteed income for most American retirees. And the average benefit for Social Security in 2021 is about $18,000 a year, right? It could be higher, but 94% of retirees take it early before the benefit peaks at 70. So if you don't know how Social Security works, you're actually incentivized to not draw from it, and your checks can be bigger if you wait until you're 70.
Yeah, you pull it earlier, you're going to get a smaller percentage of what you put into it. The more you allow that money, very similar to like an investment.
Very similar to an investment.
The more you allow that money to sit, and if you wait until your actual withdrawal dates, then you can essentially maximize your Social Security benefit.
Yes. And I should add, if you're curious about what your Social Security might, your benefit might be, ssa.gov has a calculator that I'll link to in the show notes. And you can go and look and see, you know, how much your check's going to be. And then the last one that I want to point out is that the median 401k balance for ages 55 to 62, so right around that range when people are deciding to quit, is roughly $82,000 to $84,000.
Yep.
Now, the average 401k balance is much higher. It's closer to $230,000 to $250,000. But when you think about what we talked about in the last episode, where most people assume they need to have $5 and $10 million to retire, nowhere near that is what normal retirees have saved up.
Right.
Not adding a value. I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm just telling you that these are the facts of retirement in the United States.
Yeah. And I think I'm looking at this, and it's the pessimist in me, call me what you want, but let me start with the positive. And it's your earlier point, which is that most people who are actually able to retire end up retiring early, right? The people who can afford to retire more often than not choose to retire earlier than the standard amount, right? Because they can afford to.
Right.
They've prepared for it, right? Most people can't, which they end up getting stuck in that cycle. It's like, all right, well, I'll just keep on working because, quite honestly, working for a living, if you will, is far better than being able to pull away from the job, not having any income, and being forced with the reality of having an unfunded or underfunded retirement, to your point. And oftentimes, like healthcare or some other issues sort of come into the way and make that a bit of a challenge. But what I also think is interesting was your last point, which was the conversation around like the average versus the median, because I don't know why that always brings me back to like high school, because I remember really struggling with that concept. And I think a lot of people, even till this day, struggle with that concept. And the way that I always think about it is, if you're standing around at your family dinner, you know, and you're thinking about what the median wealth is in the room, you get everyone in that room and you line them up, the person or the people that are standing in the middle, whatever their net worth is likely going to be what's considered the median net worth in that room, right? And that's probably a pretty accurate sort of reflection, or certainly closer than what the average might be.
Right.
If Bill Gates walked into that room,
right,
on average, everyone is a billionaire.
Right.
Right? Because he tips the scales.
$70 billion.
Exactly. What you're doing is you're adding Bill Gates plus all of the other people in the room, and on average, everyone's got a couple billion dollars, right? That's not necessarily, like, that can be valuable for certain forms of analysis, but when you're looking at things like 401k balances and net worth, the median is really, really important, because I think that's a more accurate reflection of what, when you lift your head up and you look around, that median is most likely going to be what you see around you, or closer to what you see than what the average may be. Mm-hmm. The average, more often than not, is really a reflection of the extremes, or how much the extremes are weighing on what people actually see. And I think that's important. Obviously, the book is top of mind. We keep talking about it, and we're probably talking about it a little bit more. But we opened the book talking about that story and that stat, and the stat in particular was based off of a study that we saw a few years ago, which basically stated that median Black wealth in the United States was slated to be $0 by 2053, so basically in around 30 years. And that did not include, when that study was released, it did not include any of the impact that the pandemic may have had on Black Americans. So loss of businesses, loss of income due to downsizing, loss of wealth due to the failure to have estate plans, loss of any of the things, right? Homes due to, you know, credit issues or medical health issues and any of those things. And so, again, I don't want to get too much into that, but I wanted to make sure that we are clarifying why it's important to know the difference between average and median when we're talking about these statistics.
Absolutely.
And which of the two might actually be a greater reflection of what you're seeing as you're looking around and thinking about the people that you see, the people that you work with, the people that are around you or in your community.
Yes. And I think the point is, again, not to assign a moral value to the $84,000 or the $18,000 that you get from Social Security. Mm-hmm. It's really just to break the mindset of thinking that you need to think about retirement solely as your investment portfolio or this big pile of money to draw down from. It may be actually more helpful to think and plan your retirement with an income portfolio in mind.
Right.
I'm not saying that these people only live off that amount and don't have other means of generating income. So the way to think about it is you still have your pile of money. Again, your savings, your investment, your Social Security payout. But if you have a gap, so going back to the example, if you needed $60,000 a year to live in retirement, by the time you factor in the $18,000 from Social Security, maybe another $5,000 from your retirement accounts and $5,000 from like a rental property you might have, mm-hmm. you're still only halfway there. So the next task is to start thinking about other income sources to supplement part-time work, freelance, contract work, to earn the other $30,000 a year. Now, I get that this is not ideal. It's not what you've heard it's supposed to be, or maybe it's not what you see for yourself.
Right.
But I'm telling you, this is how it works for the majority of retirees right now. Most people are technically retiring early. 63% retire between the ages of 57 and 66, mm-hmm. and they're just figuring it out along the way.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is when you think about the retirement crisis, right? So for all Americans, and more specifically why it's a crisis, it's because most Americans expect to maintain the same standard of living while they're not working.
Right.
Right. And it goes back to what we were saying before around the idea of detoxing from a leveraged or subsidized life. Like, retirement isn't like other milestones. Like, there's no loan that you can take out for 30 years
right.
and like pay mortgage, it back yeah. like a mortgage just so you can have it. Like, you have to save for it or do what a lot of people do, which is to find a new source of subsidization. Mm-hmm. And what is also normal is like, well, you know, your children step in to help. And that's where, when
right.
you talk
that's
about that
$10,000
to $20,000 gap, that's typically where the children come into play, or where the combination of children and or retirees living lives on credit come into play, right? Where it's like, right, this is only how much money I have. This is only so much that Junior or my daughter can offer me. And then the rest, I sort of just make a payment on a credit card. And that's normal. Like, what we see are people that are living retired lives, trying to make what they have last as long as possible, living their lives essentially subsidized on credit. And what I think is, I won't say ironic, but interesting is that, like, it all leads to the same goal, right?
Exactly.
So if right now, if we say something like, listen, the path to getting there is living lean today or seeking out multiple streams of income while you're working, which is right now, so that you can invest more, mm-hmm, so that you have more later.
And you don't have to find
And then you don't have to find these alternative sources. The other option is you wait until there's some type of career disruption, whether it's a layoff, multiple layoffs, or some type of health scare that forces you to stop working. And now you absolutely have to find these new sources. So either way, if you're underfunded, which the vast majority of Americans are, mm-hmm, you're either choosing to solve this issue now, or you're going to wait and be forced to solve that issue in the future. And that's pretty sad, but, you know, that is the unfortunate reality of it. And that's why we're really having this conversation to help people demystify what retirement is, mm-hmm, how sexy it can be for some people, but also how deeply concerning and, like, realistically crafty you will have to be, mm-hmm, when your time comes, especially if you've not done the work to prepare for it.
I think your point about retirement not being like the other milestones where you can essentially borrow money from a bank or from a creditor.
Which is what people do in the middle of their lives.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Like, to get a house or to get a car. Retirement is not that way. Like, the buck stops then.
Mm-hmm.
And even the macroeconomic solutions that have been proposed from a policy perspective still require the same steps, right?
Yep.
Experts say that we should strengthen Social Security, which is basically the country's pension plan, right? We all contribute to it automatically through our paychecks. And in order to get a bigger payout, they would need to take larger chunks from our paychecks.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people are out there saying, like, oh, no, they could just shift funding from another budget category in the government. And it's like, they've proven they're not going to do that. If that was the case, if they could move from defense spending or education or any other, you know, part of the government, they would have already done that.
Yep.
But they've proven that they're not going to. And it's not likely. The likely solution is that they would just take more from your paycheck and set it aside.
Yeah, which most people don't want.
Which most people don't want, right? Because mm-hmm, that's what we're asking you to do already, and you're not doing it. So, and then the other examples are things like making the 401k more accessible through auto-enrollment. Mm-hmm. We're seeing policies come through now where they're suggesting that every employee is auto-enrolled in the 401k. And then maybe raising the contribution limits on IRAs and other retirement vehicles.
Yep.
But today, the typical default contribution levels for most plans is around 3% of people's salaries.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you'd still need to convince somebody to take home less salary, to say you're enrolled in this 401k program. If you allocate some money to it, you'll have a retirement. And even that doesn't help people who have jobs that don't offer traditional retirement plans.
Yeah.
So all of these solutions are kind of short-sighted in a sense and still require us to take money from today and set it aside for the future.
Yeah. And I think part of the solution for our listeners out there is to put your employers and to put your retirement plans that you're most familiar with, which in most cases is a 401k, like, let's sort of put it in its place. Like, employers have certainly done their part to kind of compartmentalize 401ks and to say, well, this is what we're willing to do. But I think employees have a very romantic view,
yes,
of the 401k. They see it as this comprehensive plan that is set or designed to cover your life, much like it's like a replacement of pensions. And it is in a sense, but it does not cover nearly as many things as a pension actually did. Companies used to offer full pensions in exchange for lifetime employment, and they stopped doing that in the 70s and in the early 80s in favor of 401k plans. And by and large, the intent of that was to help employers, to help companies and businesses.
Right.
It was not
a generous
to say, well,
gesture.
Here's a better option
yeah,
for
no.
you, right? And in addition to that, it was like, No, you do it. You manage it, even though most people were ill-equipped to actually do that. And even when you think about the 401k itself, as we know it today, like it was not this brainchild or this collaborative project between government and the private sector to come up with this solution, you know, solution to supplement Social Security for the betterment of people's lives. It was literally a product of a retirement consultant. The guy's name is Ted Banna. Mm-hmm. He had a client who was looking for a way to save taxes, and he had a bonus plan, a cash payout bonus plan that he was offering his employees. He was like, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, what are my other options? What can I do that, one, helps me save on taxes, but also, like, makes me a little bit more competitive for my employees out there? And so Ted came up with this thing based on what he found in the IRS tax code, which is section 401k, which is what ultimately became the plan. And the guy actually rejected the plan. Ted ended up, I think, using it for his own company or some other company. And then because it worked so well in terms of solving both problems and was, guess what, legal, that then became the standard. Which you see this happening in politics today, right? Something happens in the private sector, someone gets in contact with a lobbyist and say, actually, this is pretty cool. Like, this actually works and it's legal. You cool with this? You cool with this? This is the new standard. And everyone sort of pretends to sort of mask it as if this is this thing that we're doing for employees, and we use the term benefit. And it's like, all right, well, it is a benefit, but it is not designed and was never, ever designed to fully be a solution that actually helps to support retirement for the vast majority of Americans. And so when we think about the issues that we're seeing today, in part, it is because comprehensive plans for retirement have been stripped away and they've been replaced by minimalist plans, which is what 401k plans are. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of people are struggling with today.
Yeah, I never knew that the 401k was named after Section 401k of the tax code.
Yeah.
I always assumed it was like representative of $401,000, like 401k. I mean, I know this now, but when I first heard about 401ks, I was like, oh, this is the way I thought I'm going to get $500,000, close to $500,000 for retirement. And then it's also wild to think about the fact that the 401k is like as old as you. Like, it's 40 years old. It's not some long-standing, proven, even if you had invested in 401k on day one and you were 40 years old, like it hasn't been around long.
No.
At all.
No.
Anyway, we'll be right back with some tips to get ahead on retirement in just a few moments after a word from our sponsors. So we've spent a lot of time just kind of talking about the myths around retirement, but I do want to talk about how to think about it in addition to, you know, an income portfolio.
Yep.
So in our book, Cashing Out, we actually teach two frameworks that help people break the cycle of thinking that retirement is something that someone else does for them, right? Mm-hmm. This is the mindset shift you have to make. And the first is the purpose of income. We did an episode on this a while back. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. But the purpose of income is basically a framework that forces you to confront three other myths that you've learned throughout your life. The first is that you'll always be able to earn income at the same level or more in the future. Mm-hmm. This is a myth that has been perpetuated by the boomers because during their time, things only went up for a long, long time. Yeah. And so that makes sense that people assume that things go up. If you are a millennial or a Gen Z, you know that things tend to go up and down. We've been through three or four of them in the last 20 years.
Yep.
The second is that employment opportunities and your desire to work remain stable over time. Mm-hmm. So again, if you came up during a boom time, you assume that there's always going to be jobs and you're always going to be healthy. There's no global pandemic threatening your ability to work.
Yep.
And so, yeah, you assume, you know, there's always going to be employment opportunities and a desire to work or ability to work. And then the third one is that there won't be unexpected occurrences outside of work that affect your spending. And again, any working professional who has lived through the last 3 years knows that there are things that have nothing to do with you, unexpected occurrences, black swan events that can affect your spending. And so the purpose of income is about you acknowledging all three of these factors, you recognizing the time that we're in, and also recognizing that your money can work way harder than you. So basically trying to walk you through how to define what is enough, right? And how to think differently about every single dollar.
So the other framework that we get into in our book is actually called the 15-year career. And actually, based on some early response and feedback from a few people who got some advanced copies, I suspect this is going to be the chapter that a lot of people really enjoy and start to follow and start thinking about exactly where they are along that particular timeline so that they can walk away. And I'm obviously not going to spoil it, or I'll try my best not to spoil it. But basically, what we're proposing here is that you should walk into or begin your career with an end in mind. And if you needed a number to put around what that end should be, that number is 15. And we speak from personal experience, we speak from the experience of others, but we also put it in context in terms of a few other things that we think about in terms of how long something should be or what is considered to be long. And the goal is pretty simple. It's like using your early years to be really frugal, pay down, and in many cases, eliminate your debt. And then using that second five to identify and build skills that are going to help you to earn supplemental income outside of your traditional job or your 9-to-5, which is very important. And then using that last 5 years to start pressure testing, seeing what you can do to earn as much money with no caps, where you have full control, so that you're essentially planning for your exit as opposed to not planning for your exit, which is what most people do today. And then it happens in a way that is abrupt and it completely derails your lifestyle, which forces you to do a quick career pivot or go into debt, trying to manage things and so on and so on. So we're really trying to prevent that for a lot of people by giving them some examples, giving them some ways to think about it, and giving you all some practical tips around how to manage your money. And that's important for a lot of the reasons that you just said. People don't begin with the end in mind. They just sort of walk into their careers very optimistically, dare I say romantically. Two, people completely underestimate, especially now, how frequent and devastating a career disruption can be on their lives. It's instant.
You think you're going to get a heads up.
I know you thought that you had 20 or 30 years ahead of you and that you were going to make these catch-up contributions.
I know you thought you had this month ahead of you. You thought you were going to get a paycheck next month. I'm telling you today.
The company's gone.
Yeah,
company's gone. The industry is officially dying. Mm-hmm. All of the things that were warning signs are officially here. The sirens are ringing. And if you've not already left, it's a little too late. Salvage what you can, grab the pens off the desk.
Yeah.
Like, that is the unfortunate reality of a lot of working professionals today. And then the other thing I think is really just socially and culturally normal for Americans, which is that we are, which may seem odd for people, but we are irrationally optimistic people. We are very optimistic people. And we talk about that in the book as well. So I'll end on that note, but I cannot leave without saying, if you haven't pre-ordered the book, please, please, please pre-order the book. I know a lot of you are listening and saying, I'm planning on getting the book. I'm going to get the book. You're not doing us a favor, actually, by waiting. It means a lot. It means a lot for you to actually pre-order the book. You can pre-order it. And basically on PubDate, which is June 14th, 2022, they'll just send it to you. If it's an audiobook version, which I actually recommend, because having just recorded, I was like, I think I would actually prefer this over the paper version. You can go ahead and order it, and then it'll pop up in your account on that day, and you'll have it. Quick tip, if you have Amazon Prime, you probably already have like a free trial for Audible. Even if you don't, I think you can get like a free trial for Audible. And that's what I would do. Like, no shade to Audible, but I would just get Audible, which is an audiobook platform, get the free trial, download Cashing Out, and then cancel Audible. You'll still actually get the book, and you get the audiobook for free.
Hacks.
Quick tip.
So I think the reason why we covered those two mindset shifts from the 15-year career to even the purpose of income is because once you can wrap your head around those things, the tactics that you've been hearing about your whole life become much easier.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
That's why you're doing it. It becomes much more applicable.
It becomes much more applicable. So we're going to spend the last couple of minutes just running through some tactics and reminding you of things that you've likely already heard.
Yep.
But the first and most obvious is to get the match on your employer-sponsored 401k if you have one.
Mm-hmm.
You need to think about that match as part of your salary that your employer is just dangling in front of you. Like, look, sis, you can have this extra $3,000-$4,000. All you got to do is this one thing, which is think about future you and ensure she can eat.
Yeah.
Like, it's a pretty solid deal. So get the employer match. And the second thing is to max them things out. Every retirement plan has its own limit and you should try to hit it, period. One way to do this is to just inch your contributions up 1% a couple times a year, right? You usually do it around merit increase time or, you know, in the winter months where you're maybe not spending as much.
Yep.
And you can always take it back down if you have seasons where you do need those dollars, where every single dollar counts. But for most people, they don't notice the little tweak because of the tax advantages. And before you know it, you're contributing 10 to 15% and knocking the goals out the park without feeling this shift in lifestyle.
Yep. 401ks obviously are great tools, but we've said it before, it's not the only tool that you can use. And so there are several others that you can do outside of your direct deposit through your company payroll. And one of the big ones is you can open an individual retirement account, which is also called an IRA. And as of 2022, you can contribute up to $6,000 or $7,000 if you're 50 or older. They do that so that you have an opportunity to catch up.
Yes.
So if you're over 50 and you haven't been, or even if you're not trying to catch up, you just want to take advantage of your ability to do that, you can contribute up to $7,000 in a year. And of course, you're going to have to decide whether or not you want to do a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. You can work with a professional to do that. We actually have both, not a big issue. And you can always sort of roll a traditional over to a Roth. It gets a little complicated, but that is another option for you. I think one of my favorite options is one that doesn't get enough love. And I think we've also done an episode on this, which is around opening a taxable brokerage account. I'm a huge advocate for taxable brokerage accounts. I feel like when people have that, it is like a sign of financial maturity. Mm-hmm. It is the act that says, I know and want the ability to manage, to decide, to control, and to take action on investing at any point without the involvement of an employer, without the involvement of even some other advisor or anything. This is just something that I want to be able to do. And I have the access and the power to do that. There are no limits to what you can contribute to a taxable brokerage account. And again, if you are primarily accustomed to investing in a 401k, you might say, well, why would I do that? Because I don't get to write it off on my taxes, or I don't get a perk or a match or anything like that. That's perfectly fine. Like, you're not always going to have that, right? But the benefit is it's yours. You have control over it. You can open it. You can fund it. You can maximize it. And by maximizing, you get to define what that is. If you get windfall money, you can decide that all of it can go to a brokerage account. If you're reading the news or for whatever reason, you are just pumped up about wanting to invest in a particular company, like depending on what side you're on, Netflix right now, since some people are looking at it like, oh, this is a buy opportunity. Some people are looking at it like, oh my gosh, it just lost, what, 30, 40 billion in about a week or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's scary. I want to run. Either way, you get, to your earlier point, the ability to take action on something most likely and most easily through a taxable brokerage account. So.
Yeah.
Big fan of those types of accounts.
I also think it's the secret sauce for moving that retirement age down to,
oh, for
from
sure.
62 to more like 50 or 45, depending on how much you start or when you start.
Well, this is why people call it a bridge account, right? So if you are 50 years old and you know that you can't make actual withdrawals from a 401k until you're, I believe it's 59 and a half or something like that, or you know you won't be able to make a withdrawal from Social Security, or you don't want to make a withdrawal from Social Security until you're 70, and you're wondering, well, where's that money going to come from? And you don't have rental properties, you don't have a side hustle, you don't have a business. This is where that brokerage account comes in. You can pull that. It's already, you already pay taxes on it, right? So you can use that to supplement a $10,000 to $20,000 or more if you choose to invest more in that account early. So that's one of the reasons why I think it's such a huge count. And it's like the, to your point, it's the bridge. It's the key that helps to solve all of those gap periods where you want to optimize the income that can be pulled from a tax-deferred investment portfolio.
And my last tip, and at least the way to fund, at least potentially fund that brokerage account, is actually to practice your retirement spending now. So the guidelines about what percentage of income you'll need in retirement, whether it's 70% or 80%, they're helpful if you just need a number, if something to aim for. But the best way to actually figure it out is to lovingly practice.
Yep.
Remember when everything was closed down and we learned how to entertain ourselves without blowing a bunch of money and going to the mall or whatever? I'm not saying go that far, but it's worth challenging yourself a couple of times a month with no spend days, right? It's kind of like a meatless Monday or a Taco Tuesday, but for finances. There's this meme that, you know, somebody said, every time I go outside, it's $200. Every day costs me $200, right? Yeah, so if you just do three of those days where it's like, I'm not going to spend the $200 that I normally would. I'm going to work from home. I'm going to eat what's in my freezer. I'm not going to buy anything from Amazon. And you take that money and you put it in this retirement account. Like, the goal is to get a couple hundred dollars every month. It makes such a huge difference. And if that's not an option for you, even just changing your shopping habits. I went to the $1.25 store the other day, which I don't feel right about calling it a dollar store anymore.
I was about to say, okay, that's a new brand.
They still call themselves Dollar Tree, but it's $1.25 Tree for real.
Inflation.
Yes, inflation. And I bought some essentials. I was walking through the aisles and realized that, like, I could save a ton of money, you know, it's not a ton of money. Don't get me wrong. $20-$25 a month. If I bought some of my essentials there instead of auto renewing from Amazon or, you know, doing the Target line pickup, like, the sponges that are in the $1.25 store are just as effective as the sponges at Target. It's a sponge. So just making sure that you're constantly reevaluating. I'm not telling you to downgrade all of your products or favorite brands, but just taking a couple of days a month where you reassess, right? Just to get a little bit of extra savings to throw into that brokerage account.
I love it. All right. Why don't we roll into final thoughts?
Okay. So my final thought is that demystifying retirement is very Wizard of Oz because the big myth out there is that retirement is this team sport, something we're all working towards. And it's not. It's not. It's very much an individual effort. A lot of the disappointment and angst that people are feeling right now is because they assume that somebody else, whether it's the government or financial institution, or in most cases, your employer, was planning for their life and valued their standards of living as much as they did. And that's just not how our labor model works. It is and has always been an imbalanced exchange.
Yeah.
Once you stop contributing, so do they. So this may be very harsh to hear, but every week we get on these mics and talk about how to flip the odds in your favor. And so I just feel like on this last week of Financial Literacy Month, this one is just too important to not get right. Yeah. You deserve a life where you don't have to work all the time.
I love that. My final thought is, I think people owe it to themselves to think about who they know that is retired in a way that they'd like to embody and have a detailed conversation with those people. I think very similar to the conversations we had about home ownership recently on an earlier podcast, you learn that many of the people we believe are doing well aren't actually doing nearly as well as you think, but we don't ever find out those details because we allow the taboo of talking about money or respect for our elders to get in the way. And as a result, we don't get to learn or reap the benefits of their experience. And in my experience, when I sort through the people who have started businesses, people who've become real estate investors, or people who just focused on investing through the stock market and keeping it simple with things like index funds, the latter are far more likely, and by the latter, I mean the people who just kept it simple and focused on index funds for a 10 to 20 year period, those people are living far more secure and fulfilling lives. Like, quite honestly, I know, and I'm not saying that to trash homeowners or to trash real estate investors, but I know several people who've had homes, nice homes, and then had some issues with those homes and had to sell. I know several people who were successful real estate investors and now 15 or 20 years in the line, they now have to get a job to help pay for health insurance or some type of issue that they've had. I don't know nearly as many people who've just focused on investing that have had those kinds of issues. That's just me. And that's a result of me having hundreds of conversations about money and about wealth with people in my social circles. And so I think you will learn a lot from people. Don't just talk to your friends. Don't just talk to your family members who are of the same age. Talk to your elders. See what's worked for them. See how the situations or the context were different for them. And use all of that to start thinking about what retirement could look like for you.
Love it. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. I don't expect to retire off this podcast, but every time y'all leave a little review, it's like increasing my contribution. So,
well played.
If you like what you heard, please leave us a 5-star rating and review, and we will see you next week.